Okay, hi everybody. Welcome. My name's Archie Thomas, and welcome to this Centre for the Advancement of Indigenous Knowledge seminar on truth-telling and the news media. I'll start by acknowledging that today I'm on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay my respects to elders past and present, and also acknowledge that sovereignty over these lands has never been ceded. So my name is Dr. Archie Thomas. I'm a Chancellor's Research Fellow here at UTS. My pronouns are he, him, or they, them. So I'm a member of the Centre for Advancement of Indigenous Knowledges, or as we like to call it, CAKE, which is a part of the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences. And I'm also a member of the School of International Studies and Education. So I'm facilitating the discussion today. And some of my research, in collaboration with other scholars here at CAKE and UTS, has focused on how media discourses frame aspirations of Indigenous people and other marginalised groups, and how Indigenous journalists operate in kind of white-dominated media spaces. So I feel, you know, very lucky to be facilitating this webinar with some quite amazing expertise from around the world here today. It is the latest and also the last in our series this year, the CAKE seminar series on truth-telling. So our focus today is whether the Australian news media is ready for truth-telling. And of course, I don't really need to tell you all, but we meet less than a month away from the referendum that will be hosted here in Australia on whether we will alter the constitution to allow for a permanent Indigenous advisory body known as the Voice to Parliament, which was, of course, first outlined in the 2017 Uluru Statement from the Heart. Famously, of course, that statement calls for a sequence of reforms, voice, treaty, and truth as a path of reform and repair for Indigenous and settler relations in this country. It seems quite clear at this point that some, familiar narratives are emerging in media coverage and the kind of larger public discourse around the voice. We've seen, kind of disinformation about the Uluru Statement itself, ideas about, supposedly secret plans for reparations, for example, or, kind of unchecked or unexplained power that the voice would, supposedly usher in, as well as, some very old and familiar discussions around Indigenous land rights and native title, and some broader debate about whether colonization itself has been a negative experience for Indigenous people. Perhaps this debate shouldn't really surprise us. In recent years, research has confirmed just how white the Australian media is in terms of its makeup and in terms of its perception of its audience and its standpoint. Plenty of research confirming how media reports through a deficit frame focused on scandal and conflict. And of course, plenty of discussion about the kind of post-truth era that we're living in, and online disinformation and other kind of strategies, which, have been quite difficult to navigate for Indigenous people and many others, especially in the context of the voice referendum. But of course, news reporting remains quite important for shaping how Indigenous political worlds are understood, and could potentially play a quite powerful role in reflecting on Australia's colonial past and its ongoing impacts on the present. And there has been some indications that Australian media and kind of Australian media landscape is changing in this regard, whether that be the kind of growing profiles of a cohort of Indigenous journalists, or the reporting of outlets, like The Guardian, which is working to avoid the kind of traps of these familiar and damaging discourses. So what we hope to do in this panel here today is to broaden the lens out to include both discussion of the context that we're grappling with here at the moment and into the future, of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and the debate around the voice, but also subsequently around truth-telling processes and the general notion of it. And we're going to broaden that out also to focus on Maori contexts in Aotearoa and Sami contexts in Norway, where truth-telling projects, both in the media, in the Aotearoa context, and in the state, in the Norwegian context, give us potentially some insight into how we might navigate and understand the situation that we find ourselves in, and kind of consider the role and responsibility of the media. So I'll introduce the panelists now, and I'll give a kind of longer introduction to them all as they speak. So as I mentioned, a pretty esteemed and accomplished group of people that have gathered here today. So first of all, we have Loreen Allam, who is the Indigenous Affairs Editor at Guardian Australia. Lorena is a Gamilaroi and Wulawai woman whose country lies in the Darawa or Naran Lakes area in far west New South Wales. She's been in support with Southwest Queensland. She's been an amazing journalist for around 30 years, worked across the ABC on a number of different programs there, and now at The Guardian, where, as I mentioned, she's the editor and has been leading The Guardian Australia's coverage of The Voice and of truth-telling. Carmen Parahi also joins us from Aotearoa. She is the Pautuaki Matua on the executive team of the media group Stuff, and she led Stuff's historic apology to Maori communities in 2020 and the research project that went along with that, and now leads their strategy for fair representation of Maori and all underserved communities informed by Treaty of Waitangi principles. We also have with us two amazing scholars from Norway. So Ellie Skogelbo is the co-director of the Center for the Study of Political Communication at the University of Oslo. She's led a major research project exploring media coverage of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Norway, which has quite recently reported its findings. That was funded by the Norwegian Media Authority. And she's also worked closely with Australian scholars on a project called Breaking Silences, Media and the Child Abuse Commission, with researchers from RMIT and elsewhere. So she's done quite a bit of interesting comparative work. We also have with us today Inka Anisara, who is an Associate Professor of Sami and Indigenous Journalism at the Sami University of Applied Sciences. In recent years, she's been working on the master's program in Sami journalism from an Indigenous perspective, and her research focuses on issues of media transparency, Indigenous and Sami journalism, and in particular, strategic communication related to the Arctic Railway. And she's especially interested in the meaning and the role of the Sami media for the debate around Sami interests and the democratic process in Sami society. So we'll be working through this amazing group of speakers in a kind of closest to furthest system today. So that means we're going to start with Loreen Allam. Our speakers will speak for around about 10 minutes each, and then we'll have some time for questions, discussion, and so forth. So, Loreen.
Thank you, Archie. I'm very honoured to be on this panel with such accomplished women. I'm very much looking forward to hearing the Māori and the Sami experience of truth-telling. It's something that we're all obviously very passionate about and doing in different ways. So I can't wait to hear what you've got to say. So I'm going to get through what I've got to say really fast. So firstly, I'll acknowledge that I'm here on the land of the Wangal clans of the Darug Nation, close to the mighty Burramattagal or Parramatta River. And as Archie said, I'm a Yuwara woman. My family come from the far northwest of New South Wales, around the Narran Lakes area, and our clan estates extend across the Whitefella border into Queensland. I'm the Indigenous Affairs Editor at Guardian Australia. And it's been a busy time for all Indigenous journalists in this country. As Archie said, we're covering the Western Parliament referendum. And I had planned to carve out some time to sit and really think about these crucial questions facing the media. But of course, the Western Parliament is a daily breaking news story, and so it has steamrolled a lot of the spare time I might otherwise have had to prepare anything considered. So I feel like this is really a top line observations from me as a working journalist about the important role that the media has in truth-telling and how much harder we still need to work to combat disinformation and outright lies in the social media age. I mean, the coverage of the Voice to Parliament referendum should provide very fertile ground for media academics to pour over in on this very point for years to come, because we're seeing a daily avalanche of misinformation and lies and fear-mongering being circulated on social media. It's hard to fact-check one claim before another equally spurious one pops up and goes viral. It's like playing this endless game of whack-a-mole with the truth. And it's all playing out at a time when news fatigue is quite high and people are switching off traditional sources of news gathering because the news is grim everywhere we look. Consequently, the faith in the reliability of old-school news is at a low ebb. And when you combine that with the rise of social media, things like COVID and other conspiracy theories, replicating online, people are getting their information from a range of sources that aren't news, traditional news. So opinions on Facebook, TikTok influencers, people they follow on YouTube. It's not, none of us, as we all know, not subject to the same editorial and legal rigor as journalism is. But consequently, there's a growing number of people, news consumers, who are immune, you know, to a lot of what they call the mainstream media or the media, like we're some amorphous group of people who all think the same, will report. So they are truth-seeking, I guess, but they're not truth-finding. And that presents a real challenge for those of us who operate in that landscape. So we all need to be really media literate to decipher the media, the info we're given these days. We all need to be reporters in the way that reporters ask questions, they check their sources, they ask to whose benefit or kiri bono, you know, why am I being given this information? To whose benefit is it that I know this? Those are the things that people meet with good media literacy ask. So it is a challenging time to work in the media. And as an Indigenous journalist, it's very challenging, particularly now, because we are exposed to a level of racist trolling online and commentary on social media, some of it driven by news organisations. And it really does take its toll. It's a really tough time to be working in this space. And I will talk about the voice to parliament later, but I really wanted to talk instead about the kind of opportunities there are for truth telling that is transformational. So something that is meaningful for the tellers as those, and to those of us who hear them and consume their stories. So the example I talk, like to talk about is the one that my colleagues, Sarah Collard, who's a Bulldog woman from WA, and I have reported recently. About 2 weeks ago, we published a series of stories called Buried Lives, which was the culmination of a year-long investigation we have been doing. And I need to warn you, it's pretty traumatic content that I'm about to discuss. We reported that a ground-penetrating radar surveys have found multiple sites of possible clandestine burials in the grounds of one of the most notorious institutions of the Stolen Generations era, the Kinchula Boys Training, Aboriginal Boys Training Home on the north coast of New South Wales. At least 9 suspicious anomalies, they've been called, have been identified by experts surveying the area. That a high priority that they say can't be explained by other information and show signal patterns that in other contexts have proven to be human burials. The report tells us, you know, we're trying to be cautious and saying we don't know how old these, we won't know for sure until like we excavate. We don't know whether they're ancient burials of ancestors or whether they are forensic, which means they're less than 100 years old. But given that the experience of those men who we call the uncles at Kinchula, it comes as no surprise to them that there could be bodies buried on the site. Kinchula was run by the Aboriginal Protection Board, or later called the Welfare Board of the New South Wales Government from about 1924 to about 1970. About 400 to 600 Aboriginal boys between the ages of 5 and 15 were forcibly taken from their families and incarcerated there under the laws and policies of what we call the Stolen Generations. There was a punishment and deprivation. This place was a hellhole, the men describe it as. Sexual abuse. There were several inquiries over time that highlighted how badly treated the boys were, and yet it continued to operate. They talk to us at length about the punishments they received for things like wetting the bed, they'd be chained to a tree overnight, or told to stand in the swamp up to their necks. These are little boys, 5, 6, 7 years old. Yeah. Their food was withheld, those sorts of punishments, whippings and beating. They first expressed concern that there might be, the boys might have met with foul play on the site. Way back in 1995, when we had a big national inquiry into the Stolen Generations called Bringing Him Home. But it wasn't until 2016 that the state government here agreed to work with the survivor organisations to do surveys of the site. And it wasn't until the end of last year that they were actually completed. Now, just quickly, the Stolen Generations, it's estimated that between 1 in 3 and 1 in 10 Aboriginal children were removed nationally during that time. So a large proportion of Aboriginal and Islander people living today are Stolen Generations or their descendants. and they are among the most disadvantaged in our communities. They have the worst health outcomes. They are better off, they're worse off in terms of housing, employment and family outcome. And so the intergenerational impact has been significant and widespread. You know, in WA, I think almost half the Aboriginal population are stolen generation descendants. So when we broke this story of the news of possible clandestine burials on the site, I mean, it was really shocking stuff. It's very distressing. Taken a toll on us personally to tell these stories. But every time we've had those feelings, we remember how hard it is for them, the uncles of Kinchula, to have lived it. And then remember how they are still telling these stories all these years later and still fighting for recognition. So in a way, I feel that it was an honour to be able to work with them to tell these stories in a way that they were happy with. And I think that's one of the most important qualities of truth-telling, is that the truth does not diminish over time. These stories haven't changed in all the years that they have told them. They keep speaking their truth, and, you know, they are hoping that people are starting to listen. So their stories are traumatising for us to hear, and as news people who read the news, it's distressing to read, but it's really necessary that you read those stories. They want you to know what happened to them. That's why they're talking. They want you to face up to the past, because they are living with it every day. It's not ancient history. It's embedded in there. It is embodied in them and their families, who are still coming to grips with what happened to them. So I think the rest of us should at least have the courage to listen with respect to what they have to say. So the overwhelming response to those stories when we published was positive and heartfelt. And interestingly, fewer and fewer people said things like, oh, I had no idea, or why wasn't I told, which are unusual default settings when you give someone a very challenging bit of information about Australian history as it relates to Indigenous people. I'd like to think those statements are becoming extinct, hopefully, because people have been told over and over. And interestingly, over time, it's the journalists who've been doing the telling. Another project I worked on with Linda Ryan, a professor of history, emeritus professor of history at the University of Newcastle, was about mapping the massacre history of Australia. And it was incredible to me, although it shouldn't be surprising, how much of the source material was colonial newspaper reports. The journalists were recording this stuff, obviously white journalists back then, but as source material, it's really, really important. And so there's a chronology, if you like, of journalists doing this work. But for each step forward in the acceptance of our history, or a fuller picture of our history, there's denial at every turn. So while most people responded to the stories positively, I really won't tell you what some of the comments have been made about them. But they do serve to underscore the old saying that people say they want the truth until you give it to them. And if it's too confronting, and it can be, they step right back into that comfort zone of deflection and denial. And what about is a good measure. So there were some comments about, well, they weren't the only kids taken, and they were taken for their own good, and all this horrible stuff. They were accused of lying. We were accused of lying, exaggerating and covering up the truth. And we were at pains to be very careful and nuanced about what we didn't resort to hyperbole. There was no need to, you know, to gild this story. It was horrific enough. And those sorts of things, the denial, those were the nicer comments we got. So the flip side of truth telling, especially in the media, of accountability, makes people uncomfortable. You cannot and should not sugarcoat a story like this one. And the outcomes were consulted at every step of the way. They were aware we were going to publish. They were prepared for the media response to it. They knew what we were writing. They saw the pictures. They understood the context in which they would be represented. So at every stage, it was very important to us to be trauma-informed in our dealings with them and in providing the right context for those stories to be told. And this is one thing that Indigenous journalists do better than the mainstream. And that's, you know, giving context to our people's stories, writing explainers about the history of a stolen generation so that readers could see this is a systemic episode in our history. It's not an isolated event, you know, because minimization is much easier there's another reaction against the truth when you aren't confronted with the scale of it. So it was very important to us to use maps and diagrams to present the scale. We tried to keep the language plain. The uncles told their stories in their own words. We worked with them for months and months to get to the point where they were ready and they were prepared to trust us. Because I hope they realize we're not in this for the clicks. Matters very much to us as First Nations journalists that we get the story right and we tell it in the right way. We know it takes as long as it takes. Can't rush the elders. You have to be patient and listen. At each stage, we had to be prepared to shelve the investigation if they said they didn't want to proceed, because that's the deal, right? This is how our people do things respectfully. The end result, I think, is a tribute to their resilience and their generosity. I hope that it's seen as considered and nuanced and contextualized with the broader Indigenous history of our nation. And so we did it so that it could be of use to everyone who wants to learn about stolen generation. So actually, I might leave it.
Okay. Thank you so much, Lorena, for sharing that and your experience in leading that work with your colleague, Sarah Collard. I'll hand over now to Carmen Prahi from STUF, who will share with us her experience of leading some similar work in Aotearoa.
Tēnā tātou katoa, e mahana ki a koe, Lorena, mō tō kaha, ki ngā e Waitara, tātou tō mātua, ka nui taku mihi ki ngā mana whenua o te rohe nei, o te rā no rohe, e tū ana koutou ki te mana o te whenua. Ngā ko, o tēnei hui, tēnā koutou, e of our Indigenous peoples. Good to see you all and to be here with you today. And thank you, Archie, and your team for allowing us to be here. So my first greetings were to you, Lorena, for your mahi and all your hard work. It is very difficult to have to tell the stories about people and tell them in a way where they're real, they're honest, and they're in the voices of our people, which is different from the voices of non-Indigenous people. Yeah? So, and mahi to you and to all of our Indigenous sisters who are doing all their mahi, wherever they are, and also to, and big greetings to everyone who's listening today. So, my tribes are Rō Whakata, Ngā Tikine, and Ngā Tikahumunu from the north and from the east of the North Island. And my role, being a journalist for 23 years, and my role at STUF at the moment is to help our organisation. So Pōtiaki is our guard post strategy. That is a Pōtiaki is a physical post that you put into the ground and it guards the metaphysical and physical aspects of the land wherever you put your post. So Pōtiaki is our strategy. It's our anti-discrimination fair representation strategy. So if it's our anti-discrimination fair representation strategy that tells you that we've acknowledged our past and our history. So 3 years ago, 2020, early 2020, a group of journalists got together and asked and spoke to our CEO who had just bought stuff from Channel 9. It had been Australian ownership for a long period of time. And we knew it was the best time for us to actually act, because we knew if it was still an Australian hat, there was no way we were going to do what we were going to do, which was to investigate ourselves, to look at our newspapers, 160 years of representation, of Māori representation and all of our publications for 160 years, that also included our digital website that's over 20 years old. And so a team of reporters from across the country looked at all the different papers, letters to the editor, opinion writing, or editorials, actually, which was really important because we needed to actually analyze the voices of our editors as well to see to check their discrimination, to understand how they have represented Māori over the years. And so what we found shouldn't surprise anyone on this call, but may surprise some of our listeners, is discrimination, marginalisation of Māori. We created negative stereotypes towards Māori through the news. And we had been outright racist in our perspective at times. We definitely marginalised the voices, taken away the stories and voices of Māori. And we actually have criminalised Māori at certain points in our history as well, which is not ideal. One of our reporters looked at how we've reported on child abuse as an example and discovered that our papers over time, including our edits, at different, this was in the 90s, so it's not that far back, 90s and early 2000s actually, we had made Māori the face of child abuse in Aotearoa New Zealand, which means that we had diminished the experiences of our non-Māori babies who were being abused and killed, but we re-emphasized the abuse amongst the Māori families. There was no context to that, so there was no colonial context, there was no poverty context, social context that comes with that reporting. And we had editors of papers who outright said, Māori, you need to sort out child abuse. And so these were some of the things that we jumped. They weren't that long ago. These were just in the last couple of decades that we discovered that. And, you know, it just wasn't clear to our non-Māori babies as well. And we also didn't hold to account non-Māori perpetrators of abuse as much as we had with Māori abusers. So there was a real imbalance there, and we had caused harm through that as one example. And so we brought this all together and we put it to our executive team. I wasn't an executive at that time. I was part of the journalism, part of the editorial team. And they agreed that we should apologise, that we needed to apologise for what we'd done, that we created a company charter, and our charter is principles related to the Treaty of Waitangi. And so we created Pōtiaki as well, which is the strategy. And what Pōtiaki does, so Pōtiaki, actually I'll talk about what we did. So charter, and then we released the apology in 2020 to Māori. Mixed bag, people calling us woke, who cares, all of this, you know, so. But also really good support, really good feedback from Māori. Of course, skepticism, saying, no, yeah, you can apologise, but what are you going to do about it after the apology? Quite rightly. And so we've created different roles, and what we're trying to do is create a culture, a Pōtiaki culture. And that culture means that every single person at staff is required to use the Pōtiaki lens over the work they do. The Pōtiaki lens is simply Māori, consider Māori perspectives and the perspectives of marginalised communities. We've identified those marginalised communities. They are basically all non-white communities, or non-Indigenous communities in Aotearoa New Zealand. So that includes our disabled people, our rainbow community, our Pacifica community, got a massive, huge Pacifica community, our different Asian communities as well. Our Asian community, to be as like, for example, the Chinese community has been here as long as the British in Aotearoa New Zealand. You wouldn't think so because their history has not told as much as British history in Aotearoa. So there's all these, and also our Indian community, they have been here as long, but their stories have been marginalised and their voices marginalised over time. And so that is Pōtiaki. Pōtiaki is that we ask our people, every single one, because we just do not have enough Māori to be able to, in our organisation yet, we are overrepresented in Pākehā New Zealand, which is white New Zealand. In our organisation, we recognise that, we acknowledge it, we don't shy away from it, it's just a fact. It's not personal, it's just a fact. This is what we deal in, facts. So that means that we're trying to teach our people. So one thing I would say about the issues that you've asked us to talk about is the Australian news media ready truth-telling, unselfconsciously white the Australian news media is, like unselfconsciously white the Australian news media is. We just need to get conscious about it because this whole, I don't even understand that word. I don't even know why anyone would use that word. The facts are that all about Australia, all about our Western news media have been created through colonialism. People hate talking about colonialism, but the C word is the P here. Colonialism created the system of the media. The media, like all other systems, created through colonialism, such as justice, education, health. They were all set up through colonialism. The media system is no different. So therefore, we have colonial practices within our media system. We all like to think our media is independent and we all do our own thing commercially and through government funding. Yes, but we also have a system and an industry, and that industry is colonial in its perspective. It's colonial. It's historically colonial. Therefore, those practices continue to exist. If you're not aware of them, you should be now. People, educators have been telling the news media for a long time about that Eurocentric monocultural perspective we all use when we tell our news story. That framework does not serve people, Pākehā people or white people. It only serves white people. It doesn't serve anyone else out with that framework. And Lorena was really, it was true what Lorena said. People do not want to hear the truth. And so just as people like to shoot at the messenger, as news people, we know everyone comes at us because we're the messenger. Within inside the messengers, the home of the messengers and news organizations are other messengers. Those are the indigenous voices, the women of color voices, or the disabled people voices. They are messengers through that also people within the news industry try to suppress and try to ignore and pretend, no, we don't do that. We're fair, balanced, accurate in the way we do our news. Yes. But because you are fair, balanced, and accurate, you would use accurate lens across your news, which is a multi-lens approach, which is understanding that you work in a colonial system just like everybody else does. And you need to accept it and understand it and then start to create practices that actually help you be a better journalist, a better newsroom. So those three things, colonialism and historical ignorance. Historical ignorance means we do not have the context to be able to deal what the voice render referendum or any other issues when it comes to Indigenous peoples. It really is as simple as that. Without history, because I know, I'm sure you haven't heard all of the history of our Indigenous peoples. You haven't gone to our Indigenous people and got them to tell you their history. It's the same thing in New Zealand. Did you know that in New Zealand, this year is the first year that we have actually got history, Māori history and New Zealand colonial history being taught in schools? It is now compulsory this year. It's 2023, for God's sakes. What that means is we have generations and generations of people who are ignorant about our history, who cannot contextualize the issues that we are currently facing today for Indigenous people and marginalized communities. And therefore, we can create that beautiful, wonderful vision of the future together without at first acknowledging our ignorance and our history of colonialism in the media.
Great. Thank you so much, Carmen. Certainly some truth-telling there, I think, about the C word and some other important lessons for all of us. So thank you so much for sharing that and, you know, for all your work in Aotearoa and at Stuff and more broadly. So our next speaker, Eli Skogabo, will speak about the context in Norway in relation to the truth-telling commission that has recently occurred there.
Thank you, Archie. Yes, I just have to say first, good morning or good afternoon to everybody, depending on where you are on the globe. I think Inger Anna is a bit further north than me, but otherwise, I think you are in the afternoon. I want to start with recognizing all past, present, and future owners of the lands that the seminar is held on. Even though I am in Oslo, I think that's a recognition that I will share with you. As you said, Archie, I'm at the University of Oslo. I work with political communication and political journalism. I've done that for longer than you would ever want to know. So I will not bore you with that, but I've worked with the research concerning structural conditions for voice participation and representation in many aspects, but also Indigenous. I think before I say very much about the Truth Commission project. I want to say that because you might wonder why I am here. I am a non-Indigenous scholar from Norway, not even from Sápmi, where Inger Anna is, and you can talk more about that, Inger Anna. I'm very happy to have you with me. But I have to explain a little bit my background. I have a personal history that over the years has become more and more important for me as a researcher too. I've always been involved in research on democratic communication, participation and things like that. But I also have a family parts of my close family is Indigenous. That is, they are Sami. My children and my bonus children, as we call them here in the Nordic countries, I have a lot of them, all identify as Sami, as their father did. And so do, of course, their uncles and aunts and grandparents, friends and family, even boyfriends and girlfriends. So that's the story that means more and more also for my research. It does not alone, of course, explain why I, many years ago, wanted to try and find, to do research and be involved with Sami, but it explains a lot of why I have now, rather painfully, I think, also, have intimate knowledge of what consequences colonization, racism, discrimination, harsh assimilation processes have on individuals, families, groups, and the culture as such, not only the culture, society as such, and the constant fights for land, for lands, rights, and recognition that the indigenous peoples fight every day. So my own personal experiences have hopefully contributed to learning more or getting insights and at least respect for peoples and cultures that have been close to eradicated, made invisible, silenced. In the Norwegian public domain, in the Nordic, I should say, until the present day, even though now there are more conflicts and therefore also more attention. So that was the first thing I wanted to say. In addition, I also professionally have for many years been lucky enough to work in research projects with Sami scholars, Sami academics in the Nordic countries, among them Inger Anna and many others. And I've led several research projects that have investigated reporting, communication in news and social media on Sami issues in the same area. It's always difficult to define where to start and what to begin, but at least we have the Sami people who live in Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia. Means that they are divided by separate laws, different media system, extremely little knowledge in the majority populations, very different languages from all the Scandinavian languages or from Norway and Swedish, a little bit closer to Finnish. Inger Anna, you can say more about that if you like. And I experience every term, lastly, on Friday, how little my students at the master level actually knows about our common histories, about indigenous history, politics, society, culture, language. So that's one of some of the professional background that keeps this very relevant. And you mentioned that I also have worked with Australian colleagues, Archie, in the Breaking Silences project, led by Kerry McCallum in Canberra, and include many brilliant Australian scholars too. The Breaking Silences project is relevant for my research because it we investigated media reporting on that. And unfortunately, child abuse, child removal is central to everything that has to do with Indigenous history. It's a very, very sad and disturbing and bad thing. Also in Norway, this is one of the parallels that we see. And one of our findings in the Breaking Silences project, in among very many other, was of course that the enormous attention given to the Royal Commission, to its report, to the scandals, to the reporting. But one of our findings there was that the reporting was also very uneven, very hierarchical, and the cases involving Indigenous children were overshadowed and received far less attention than the high-profile scandals, as I'm sure you have knowledge of that. So that was a little bit of the background. The project that I'm working on now, it's not financed anymore, and it's not very big, but we still do it. The investigation of the reporting on the Norwegian Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I don't know how much you know about that, but it was set. I will just give you the brief thing. It was set up in 2018, the original initiative for the Truth Commission came from the Sami Parliament in Norway. It was intended to be a commission for only the Indigenous people when it was initiated. It actually covered also two of the national minorities. If you want more detail, I can answer questions, but that's the basics. The report of the Norwegian Truth and Reconciliation Commission was presented only 3.5 months ago, on 1st of June this year. And of course, the submission to Parliament received not much, but at least it was reported on in all the main media. Now the sun is getting into my eyes here, but maybe for a little bit. It was reported on the days when it was presented, and there were some comments calling this the report of shame, finally getting to terms with Norwegian history of colonization, assimilation, racism, and so on. But the main results that we have is that during its 5 years in operation, there were very little attention given to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the mainstream media. Even though the commission operated on behalf of the Norwegian Parliament, and we should say, despite the intentions of the Norwegian cabinet, who didn't want to report at all, mainstream news journalism hardly paid attention to it. That's the main findings that we have. And of course, we have tried to find out why that is. Whether it was just that mainstream media were unwilling, racist, colonial, as you say, Carmen, I couldn't agree more, actually, or simply unknowledgeable. Or do we also have to look for other explanations? Some of the things that we highlighted is, of course, the overshadowing effects that we always saw. That when we compare the findings to the Royal Commission, we saw that there were major differences in the strategies of the TRC compared to that. The TRC chose a strategy that was very silent in itself, waited for 5 years to publish all its results and so on. Did not give any what we call information subsidies to journalism, nothing, very little. That was probably important. But also the simple facts that Indigenous issues in itself has a little market was important. So Yeah, we had, I don't want to go over my time, Archie, so I think I'll just wrap it up. But I think what we find is that I'll agree with Carmen that if we want to change this system, I think recognizing the fact that there are structural factors in the media, in journalism, that disadvantages indigenous issues clearly, and make conscious reporting, conscious choices, is among the most important findings that we have so far. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ellie. And I think there's some common themes emerging amongst the speakers, which we'll be able to explore in a little more detail in the discussion. So our next speaker, Inka Arni, will be discussing her research in the Sami context as well.
Thank you, Archie, for this invitation to this very, very important seminar. Good evening, Australia. Good morning, Oslo. Oslo. Yeah, I first wanted to say just a few words. Thank you very much, Ellie, for your important work. It really means a lot to the Sami communities. And Lorena, when I see how bold you are bringing up those terrible, terrible stories, I really wish that our journalists would do more and bring those horrible stories to the daylight. And what you say, Carmen, is really true, that the mainstream media that is said to be objective really is the kind of a part of the establishment supporting the values of the colonizers and of the mainstream society. So that is a thing to keep in mind. I say a few words about myself. I work in Norway at the Sami University of Applied Sciences. I used to work for the Journalism Studies. Unfortunately, we don't have them now. I work for the Reindeer Herding Bachelor's Program now, but I keep continuing researching the journalism issues and the frames and the media representations of Indigenous and Sami people. I will put this important issue to the historical context because I think that it's really important to understand the history behind it and also the political climate and the agenda setting effect that occurs here. I say also a few words about myself. I'm from Finland, Finnish side of Sapmi, from Ohtiukka, but my Sami roots are in Norway, in Kautokeino, where I work right now. So yes, I will say a few words about the historical context of the truth and reconciliation process that we have now, so that the establishment of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Finland, it is of course a part of the greater whole of strengthening the rights and position of the Sami as an indigenous people in Finland. So therefore I really need to add some words about history of the mainstream media representations of the Sami in Finland. Kind of there has been either silent or quite negative news coverage in the Finnish mainstream media when it comes to the promotion of the rights of the Sami in Finland. And what tells a lot in Finland that over the decades, both the politicians and authorities have said that we don't have no need to apologize for the historical injustices that had happened in Sapmi. Sometimes there has been an extensive news coverage when, for example, the Act on the Sami Parliament and the ILO Convention number 169 has been in the legislative drafting processes and are, of course, discussed in the Finnish Parliament. I myself also research the non-decision making related to this adoption of the ILO Convention, and I really found horrible frame and accusations against the Sami people in in Finland. So the blocking power had been used against the Sami people and Sami interests also in the news media. And after that, there has been a silence again. As other speakers also have addressed that, in addition to the silence, there is a majority population's lack of knowledge of the Sami people and our affairs. So in the public debate on the Sami people and Sami issues as an indigenous people, the news coverage is kind of a twofold. Over the years and over the decades, the news coverage of the Sami culture, the cultural things like joy, the Sami way of singing and the Sami outfit, kakti, and other Sami, the handicrafts and other cultural things, they have been covered quite positively. But when it comes to the land rights and extended participation rights of the Sami in relation to the industrial development, and of course the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the attitudes of the mainstream population and the news coverage has been quite negative for a long, long time. So I need to highlight that these things that I now tell you are my personal observation as a Sami journalist, as a Sami researcher, and as an indigenous person. And I must say that one of the worst frames that has been promoted over the years on the when it comes to the promotion of the rights of the Sami is that the mainstream media says that it violates the rights of the majority. But luckily, recently, there has been a shift in focus when it comes to the public debate surrounding the rights of the Sami and our position as an indigenous people. And there is, as I mentioned, a transfer of salience from the political agenda to the media agenda. And now I'm talking about the political agenda of the mainstream population. As you may know, the former Prime Minister of Finland, Sanna Marin, who is very well known, Finnish politician also abroad, stated that as a rule of law and a human rights state, Finland has obligation towards the Sami as an indigenous people. And it's a shame, and Finland should be shamed about that, that it does not fulfill its obligations towards the Sami. So kind of a here we can see that kind of a partly the political climate has changed. Also, there is this Swedish People's Party in Finland that represents the Swedish speaking minority in Finland that has been very active for a long time in promoting the rights of the Sami, and also in the establishment of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. But the thing was that the support from the other political parties always lacked, but now the game kind of has changed a little bit. So as I said, that there has been kind of a positive transfer of salience from the political agenda to the media agenda. And in such a way, the news coverage of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has been covered more kind of a set neutrally or even slightly positively by the mainstream media in Finland, such as the public broadcaster Yle in its current affairs, the programs and TV news. But it's only a minor change. The silence probably is not there any longer, but the change is very, very small so far. Also, many Finnish artists and other public figures, such as actors and filmmakers, have publicly supported the promotion of the rights of Sami, and also that has also affected very, very positively to the media representations of Sami. So if I say a few words about the Truth and Reconciliation process, so most of the time, of course, I have followed the news coverage of the Sami media and also the public broadcaster Yle and its Finnish outlet. So we have this, which is the Sami department of the Finnish public broadcaster Yle, as we also have in Norway. NRK Sapmi, which is a part of the Norwegian public broadcaster. So it's very, very important and essential that the Sami in Finland have their own Sami public broadcaster that can disseminate information, perspective, frames, and representations that support indigenous Sami communities in the process of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Finland. Even though the mainstream media's coverage nowadays has been more neutral or even slightly positive, it informs the general public on the Truth and Reconciliation process only superficially. So, therefore, the role of the Sami media is really, really important. Really, the Sami media that really informs the Sami people about the process. For example, when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Finland organizes public discussions and hearings around Finland. And the Sami media also has informed individual citizens to share their experiences to the commission, to meet face-to-face, to meet online, or that it's possible to write a letter to the commission. We are now in the very beginning of that Truth and Reconciliation process. So there has been kind of a very little so far about the experiences of the people, what they have experienced. But it's not only about the historical injustices. It is also about the injustices that take place now, today, in Finland. And this is also another matter that the mainstream media never tells about. It does not inform the Sami people about the very difficult beginning of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission process and work. Because the thing was that earlier the two members of the commission quit and resigned from the commission because of the lack of trust against the Finnish state and against the reconciliation process. So these are the things that the mainstream media still keeps out of the news coverage. So in that way, the role of Sami media is very important because in that way, it also informs in Finnish, the Finnish and the mainstream population also what is really happening in the Truth and Reconciliation process itself. And Yle Sapmi also reported about some Sami politicians saying that in Finland there are no prerequisites whatsoever to continue the Truth and Reconciliation process, since the state is keeping violating the rights of the Sami in other arenas, such as the legislative drafting processes and the industrial development that is taking place in Sapmi. So there are those issues that the mainstream media never ever deals with. It is the political support from the mainstream politicians in this process has been really, really relevant. The chairperson of the commission, Hanna Lepokka, also told via Yle Sapmi that the Finnish state really needs to build trust towards the Sami people and in such a way to make a reconciliation process possible. So there are kind of two things that we need to recognize. We need to recognize the political support also that we can see, see in the news coverage that is really needed and really helpful. So this is the kind of a thing that the mainstream media never reports and should report more. But in that way, the Sami media and its role is really very important because it's also reporting in Finnish and in that way also informing the mainstream Finnish population. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I think some fascinating insights there, and also some parallels, I think, between the context in relation to the importance of Indigenous journalism and Indigenous media. Interesting that the call for, you know, a Sami broadcaster emerges in the Finnish context at this moment, because similarly in Australia, NITV emerged from the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. You know, Maori television is, you know, connected to the Treaty of Waitangi and so forth. So we can see some real similarities between the importance of Indigenous media to sort of put forward Indigenous voices in the absence of that happening. So I've got, you know, a couple of questions to ask, but I'll also say at this point for, you know, the audience who's watching today, now's your chance to type in some questions for any of the speakers. We've got about 20 or so minutes. But just on that last point, Ellie, I know that in your writing, you've written about the importance of, you know, Indigenous journalism as kind of insider reporting. And Lorena, when you were talking as well, and Carmen too, both about some of the kind of ways that Indigenous journalists are able to approach journalism with a different kind of ethics, you know, potentially come at it from, you know, different angles. Lorena, you talked about kind of trauma-informed reporting, the kind of leading of Indigenous voices in your work, and Sarah Collard's work about the Kinchella Boys Home. I'd be interested in what people think about that idea, about, you know, the idea of an Indigenous kind of ethics of journalism, and in what ways it kind of brushes up against sort of traditional, you know, news values, or the, you know, those structural factors that people have spoken about. So that's a question for anybody on the panel to expand on.
Can I say, I think this question of Indigenous journalism versus real journalism, should that be the, I don't know. That's one of the issues that I've taken a stand on a long time ago, because that's an issue that you very often hear, is that, oh, Indigenous journalism is too close to things and things like that. But that's the fact about any type of journalism, I suppose, that journalists should be close to what they are covering. That's one thing. They should have knowledge. And I also think that, being non-Indigenous myself, I also know that it's very difficult to work with Indigenous issues without very, very much knowledge, and to be invited in by those with much more knowledge than yourself. So I think the idea of Indigenous journalism, I think it's established now. It's both within the colonial structure, I think we have to say that, but also as media or in their own rights, that may or may not operate within the same structural factors. So, yes, I'd like to hear other voices on that.
Thanks, Ellie.
Yeah, I can.
Sorry, go. You go, Ellie.
Yeah. You just go ahead.
I just wanted to say that it's difficult to be, well, there's two kinds of media. There's the media where we are talking to our own mob in community languages, that is community-based broadcasting. In Australia, it's mostly radio, but TV as well. And then there's NITV, which is the Indigenous Television Network, that has a huge, really important role in talking to our mobs, but also presenting our issues to a wider audience, because they have a much more broad audience. And then people like me who are working in the mainstream, I feel like we are all, if there's a fire front, we're all at different spots on the front trying to put the fire out. So that's the analogy I would use, but we all have different challenges in that environment. I think the one thing that unites us is that we have two audiences. We have two bosses, if you like. There's the bosses of our mainstream outlets, but also our mobs, our people, who are our real bosses, and they will tell us if we've done the right thing or the wrong thing. So in a way, working in the mainstream, you have two obligations. You have the obligation to your people as well as to the news outlets you work with. They're very rarely the same. They also know at odds to one another, and it's always a challenge to navigate. That's what I would like to point out. It's not easy. There's always it's a process of negotiation, always.
Okay, I will continue here. Yeah, there has been an ongoing discussion over the decades, I think some 30 years, among the Sami journalists and the journalist, Sami Journalist Association, that there is a need to establish the code of ethics, the Sami code of ethics for the journalists. But so far it's been on the level of discussion. Somebody mean that we really need some indigenous codes of ethics, and somebody say that the mainstream code of ethics should be okay to the Sami journalists as well. So there are both views. But I think personally that the ethics issue is very important, because it is the tool to build trust also to your audiences. So in that way it's really, 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 really important. And you kind of need to find a balance between the needs and interests of your own society and the codes of ethics that exists in journalism. Thank you.
Armin, did you want to add something?
Oh, yeah. So, because I work in multimedia as well as mainstream, as well as commercial media, as opposed to and state media as well. So I've had the luxury of working across all of the parts. And I think it's important, actually, that there is a wide range of Māori journalists across the New Zealand landscape media, because then we get away from this, all Māori are the same. They all think the same. They all speak the same. We do not. We all look different. We all sound different. We all have different tribal characteristics. And it's really important that Māori voices in the media or journalists also are able to be themselves and be in different parts, broadcasters, print, digital, whatever. So it's good to have all of those. I like to call them all the different streams that feed into journalism. It is important to teach journalists to understand and report on Māori issues, because it is not for Māori journalists to just be the only journalist in the newsroom who has to report on all things Māori. And in fact, you wouldn't say to a non-Māori journalist, yo, you report on all things non-Māori, and the Māori journalist only reports on all things Māori. No. So if it's not fair for one, why would it be? It's unfair to put that cultural burden on Māori journalists to be the only ones to tell Māori stories. Everyone should be trained on how to connect in with communities. Can I say, this is old-fashioned, old-school journalism here, where you put your shoes on and you physically go out and you start talking to people, right? So that's how you do it. Face-to-face, kānuri, get the kānuri, face-to-face stuff, you build trust over time. And yes, we have lost the trust of Māori, but in this time of declining trust against all measures in the media, what has been interesting for us at Stuff is actually our Māori audience has not declined. So where other audiences may be declining, our Māori audience stayed with us. And I think it's because part of it is because we're working harder and harder at understanding how to connect, how to report on all things Māori, using the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi to help inform that reporting. And we have editors who say, well, that just goes against everything that journalism has been doing. We're like, yeah. And that goes, and if we don't, it goes against fairness and equity and balance and everything we say we stand for as journalists. If it hasn't been working for Māori today, then obviously we have to change something. So good old-fashioned journalism, face-to-face, get out and meet your communities and talk. It's going to take time, and so it should. And then you just build trust over time. You don't have to be Māori to connect with Māori. And in fact, Māori communities, as Lorena said, they're harder on us than non-Māori communities. So we get it more from our own people than we do from non-Māori. So there are ways to just train all journalists to be comfortable journalists aren't there to just represent white Australia or white New Zealand or non-Indigenous, Sami people. We're there to represent everybody. That's what a journalist does. They're there to represent everyone. So you need to have different lenses, understand what your bias is, understand what your culture is and the way you view the world, and then change your lens. So when you're standing in front of the Prime Minister of your country, you can speak for Māori communities about issues that people are currently facing. So, for instance, we did COVID, right? We had COVID lockdowns in New Zealand. You all heard about it. We should have had reporters standing there and talking generally. Okay, what are you doing, government, Prime Minister? Why are you locking us down again? But at the same time, they then change the lens and say, okay, for our Māori communities, we know that they're more susceptible to COVID, that it will go in and it will wipe them out if we do not protect our Māori and vulnerable communities, our disabled people, Māori, Pacifica, all of these people that are overburdened with health inequities, right? So as a reporter, change your lens. Understand that you have a monocultural lens on there, change it so that you then stand up and you speak on behalf of other communities.
Absolutely. Thanks for that. Yeah, I think some of what's coming up in that discussion relates to a question that's been asked in the chat, you know, about the way potentially some of the traditions or values of journalism might, you know, come into conflict with actually doing justice, you know, to Indigenous stories and voices and, you know, non-white standpoints. So Catriona, who works in the journalism program here at ETS, asks, says, you know, thanks for the illuminating talks. And he's also asking, and I think it's great, we've got both journalists and educators of journalists here to answer this question. What sort of measures could be taken to train Indigenous journalists, but also develop, you know, knowledge and capacity amongst non-Indigenous journalists and journalism students? Would anybody like to?
I'd really like to start on that one, IT.
Please.
And I speak as a working journalist, not as an academic. I see so many young graduates come into our industry who are stunningly unaware of Indigenous people and history. Even today, I'm shocked at how little they know about us. And that's only, I mean, Cohen, you're talking about how modern history has now only this year become compulsory. In Australia, we have compulsory Aboriginal history in primary school, and it's a very truncated version. Obviously, they don't learn about the stolen generations to the same extent. And, you know, it's a edited highlights, if you like, and it's voluntary. It's in high school. So a lot of young people will get to graduate university without having ever really spent any time learning about or comprehending Indigenous people and culture and history. And then end up in a newsroom where, like, now the biggest story every day is about the Indigenous voice to parliament referendum coming up next month. And we are really seeing that absence of understanding in the way that the media is reporting this story. I mean, it's really disappointing. I mean, we shouldn't be surprised, but it's incredibly disappointing that educators, journalism educators, are still 99% white, middle-class people in this country, and they're not teaching enough about Indigenous journalism. There's a history of Indigenous journalism now that they could learn. There's ways, and I think you were talking about the ethics, or Indigenous ethics, like they could learn those concepts at universities. Just universities are just not doing enough for that. They don't have Indigenous media academics, for a start. There's very few of them around. Dr. Amy McGuire in Queensland is one that springs to mind, and, you know, Mom will tell me of others that I might have missed, but they're few and far between. And that really underscores what Carmen was saying about how the media is a kind of pillar of colonization. So the education of journalists has to step up much more because, you know, in newsroom, we were struggling with how to better represent our communities, how to reflect diversity in the newsroom. We're still getting graduates who are overwhelmingly white middle-class kids. Yeah. And that's not suiting anyone's. It's not helping them because they're thrown into stories they know very little about. They should be learning much earlier in their careers about how to do it right. and how to apply the same principles of journalism they would apply to any other story to cover in Indigenous affairs and to do the job properly.
Yeah, I totally agree with Lorena that that is the thing that that we should do. We should start already from the primary school to teach the histories and industries and traditional knowledge and et cetera already at that level. We are building that system in Finland. I have been in a Sami school myself from the primary school level. And this is the reason also why we have the Sami University of Applied Sciences, that it is to educate teachers and journalists and other workers for the society that are aware of the Sami history and the industries and languages and everything that we have past and present in our society. Thank you.
I think I should comment on that. I think you are absolutely right. The University of Oslo just now doesn't now, we don't, probably it's not the biggest journalist education, but it's absolutely clear to me that we don't, that we, nor the, what I call secondary school, some would call that high school, but also primary schools, that we receive students up to us who has gone through all the schools before with very little education in this. They have had, it's not true that they don't learn anything, because they have the mandatory day or two during the year around the celebration of the Sami People's Day in February, and they have some food and some, but it's buried. And when they come to us, we teach them media communication, media studies. And of course, we do put in some history, but I break down and say that we simply do not put in very much of the Indigenous history. We try to do it, and of course, I'm also alone in my department, being the one who carry two flags, different flags. But it's simply not enough. And we, as I said, only the last course I had, which ended on Friday, with very, very interested, engaged, fantastic students, but very few. And they didn't know anything about Truth Commission's history, colonization of Norway, and so on and so forth. So there is an enormous challenge out there. And I also think it's fair to say that universities, I work at Norwegian's oldest university. It's clear that we have a colonial history that's very, very strong. You know, the University of Oslo has its own skeleton collection, which is now managed by the Sami Parliament. It's a very heavy history that we have to, and we have to fight also that history when we educate our students. Has to be done. It's not done without fight, but it has to be done. Thank you.
And
it's
the thing
hard
is
for it's not hard for newsrooms to bring in educators and do it themselves. Like, you know, the journalism scopes are an issue in the first instance because there is a barrier there for our Indigenous kids to even go to universities in the first instance. So then it becomes, well, we can train them in our newsrooms, but then you have intersectionality and bringing in people who have suffered a range of trauma that you try to bring in to become journalists, because journalists are hard-ass people who love to run towards the fire and crack into some serious issues, even if it upsets them and makes them cry and want to hit somebody. You have to be a type of person to be a journalist. And we have made spaces available where I work. And we've learned some very hard lessons, which was just because you want to brown up your newsroom, it doesn't mean it's going to work if you don't bring in the right people with the right characteristics anyway to be a journalist. So, and then you've got to think about all of the intersectionality of the types of trauma they also bring in and understanding that as well. So there are lots of levels to improving our representation of our Indigenous peoples around the world, but making sure that there's cultural safety for the people that are in those newsrooms and helping our journalists who aren't Indigenous to be able to stand up and do their journalism work on behalf of all communities, not just their own community. And so it'll take lots of, you have to pull lots of different levers to help to improve this representation and improve the equity of that representation and make sure that it's culturally correct as well. So there's lots of things you can do. You can have multimedia, which we do. You have different digital broadcasting, radio media. You have Māori who work in mainstream and at different levels, but there's just not enough. But at the same time, you have non-Māori who can train up. So journalism newsrooms can train themselves, but they have to be culturally safe to bring in all those people. If newsrooms aren't willing to look at their own history, understand what harm that caused in their reporting, acknowledge it, and start to take the steps necessary to mitigate those risks and harms that caused, because it'll continue and nothing will improve. We are dealing with misinformation, disinformation. We're dealing with white supremacy issues and underlying that misinformation and disinformation, trust the news, and also people have just been turned off by the news and so there's just so much that has to be done. But you just come up with a plan and take it step by step. We're still the fuck. Like we've moved forward so much and I'm really proud of our organization. But we're still stuff up. We still have cultural issues within our business. But that's okay. We acknowledge it. We know it. We recognize it much sooner now than we used to. And we continue to incrementally move forward. If we allow all of our detractors and our critics to shut us down, all of our progress will be for nothing. And so our plan is yes to improve, but our plan, like all Indigenous people, is a 5, 10, 20, 50, 100-year plan, 200-year plan. This is not about, oh, I just want to make some money the next 2 years. No, this is actually a plan to improve. If we want to sustain journalism, then there are lots of things we have to do. And our representation of Indigenous people dealing with our colonial history and our Western media are the steps that are necessary to improve our journalism. And can I say, voice referendum was on the same day as New Zealand's election, which I thought was really fun. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. So not only will we be reporting on the voice referendum and the results of that in New Zealand, we will also be reporting on who comes into government. So we will have a Conservative national government because it is theirs to lose, even though Labor is currently in government. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens. We had Māori electorate seats in Aotearoa, New Zealand, since 1867. 1867. We have had Māori Indigenous representation since 1867. We still have those electorate seats, the Māori electorates. You can choose to be on the general roll, Māori roll. I am on the Māori roll because I support fundamentally the principles of having those Māori seats. Of course, the detractors and our political parties and leaders are currently saying, we don't need those. It's separatists. Have you heard this language in Australia? And with our Sami people as well. It's separatists. We are all one people. Why are they getting special treatment? All of these things, we have dealt with those for since 1867, and we continue to have our seats. So it is very sad for me to see the polling around the voice referendum. And I'll say this on behalf of my sister Lorena, because I know she doesn't want to cop the flack that comes from talking about the voice referendum in Australia. And so it is sad for me to see the polling results so far. But you know what? Our Indigenous people don't need other people to tell them who they are, how awesome they are, that their culture matters, their language matters. And in fact, we don't need anyone to tell us who we are and what we're about. We have plans for our future and the future of our children. And so we, whether our people, our cousins, our brothers and sisters over in Australia get that class referendum or not, we will continue to support them and their manamutu haki and their self-determination and independence and our Sāmi brothers and sisters too. We don't need a referendum to tell us how amazing we are as Indigenous people.
Thank you, Carmen. And thank you to all of our speakers in the context of, yeah, what has been a difficult referendum, particularly for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, where we've seen a lot of racism kind of platformed in the public debate. You know, this discussion, well, tonight for us, this morning for some of you, has, you know, given me and hopefully others, you know, some sustenance to kind of carry things forward. I think there's some common themes that have emerged in terms of the legacy of colonization, the importance of historicization in media reporting, the importance of the perspectives of Indigenous journalists, both, you know, in Indigenous specific media, but across, you know, all the fire fronts, as you put it, Lorena, and kind of continuing to challenge the kind of norms and structures and barriers that exist across all sorts of facets of media and the public discourse. So on that note, I would, you know, congratulate, you know, all of our speakers for the work that they do in that, which takes, you know, much courage and much risk to, you know, put yourself in those positions and to advocate in the way that you all do as journalists and scholars and researchers and teachers. And I have certainly learned a lot from all of you this evening and hope to continue to do so. So thanks so much, everybody, for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Bye,
everybody.
See you later.
Hey, hey.